There we go. We're recording.
Now we're recording.
Now we are recording.
Well, I can't say much for the circumstances, but at least it's your big chance.
A big chance. For what, Doctor?
Command. Oh, I know you, Mr. Spock. You've never voiced it, but you've always thought that logic was the best basis on which to build command. Am I right?
I am a logical man, Doctor.
Well, it'll take more than logic to get us out of this.
Perhaps, Doctor, but I know of no better way to begin. I realize that command does have its fascinations, even under circumstances such as these. But I neither enjoy the idea of command, nor am I frightened of it. It simply exists. And I will do whatever logically needs to be done. Excuse me.
Welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I am Terry DeFellin, and I'm joined, as always, I'm happy to say, by Derek Mantle.
Hello.
Or even Derek Mantle.
Hello.
And Graham Sibley.
Hello.
How are we doing? All right, chaps?
Yeah, we're fine. Yeah. How are you?
Yes, very good, very good. Enjoying the Easter as we're recording
and
this.
We have Easter treats.
We have Easter treats ahead of us in nice, swirly, spacey colours.
It is. It is.
Made by my wife, no doubt, feeling, you know...
Very Easter-y.
Yeah, we'll have a. She made a bit of a quasar-like substance for us to chow down on. It looks very nice.
It does.
But we won't be eating it now in front of you, listeners, because that's all right. Because we know that many of you don't like the sound of people eating over a microphone. It sounds a bit. Yeah,
it does a little bit.
Yeah.
Especially if you're wearing earbuds, because it's right in
there.
Yeah. It's almost as bad as eating something when you're wearing earbuds.
Yeah. Oh, well, I've never tried that.
Oh, don't.
Yeah, okay. I probably have, actually. I must have done.
Well, when you swallow, it makes it sound like you're like swallowing a safe.
A safe? Do you say it makes it sound like you're swallowing a safe?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm sorry,
okay.
That does not compute.
Like swallowing an anvil.
Yeah. No, that doesn't work either. Okay, maybe we should...
Now we get into some Tex Avery cartoons.
Yeah, you know, it's like comes out like and it's like stretches your neck as it goes down.
Yeah. Now that I can understand.
Yeah, you can see that now.
I just wonder how you know what swallowing a safe sounds like.
Well, it's a very funny story. Actually, if you press the red button now,
you'll hear the story of how Graham knows what it's like, what someone swallowing a safe sounds like. But we're not here to talk about that, even though we are currently talking about that. We're here to talk about the Star Trek episode, The Galileo 7, from the first season of the original series. A brief summation of the plot. As I'm sure many of you are aware, Spock leads a landing party to examine... Not a landing party, it's a survey on the shuttlecraft to examine the Murasaki Quasar.
Yes.
It goes horribly wrong within minutes of having left. And they end up, the quasar interferes with the equipment, they end up crash landing on a Class M planet which is inhabited by very large, very primitive species who are out to get them. Meanwhile, the quasar has affected the Enterprise and is savagely curtailing the prospects of Kirk and the crew finding the Galileo crew in time. Because to add extra peril... Federation or Galactic Commissioner Ferris is placing them under pressure to go on to their next mission, which is a life-saving mission, in fairness, for plague victims on the planet Marcus III, I think.
Yeah, with New Paris.
So, that's right. So, working against the clock, Kirk and Spock separately have to find ways of getting themselves back into orbit and getting themselves rescued, and the excitement ensues from there. I'm sure you can all appreciate that they get there in the end. There's a layers to this episode, and it's a deep episode. It's a big Spock episode, so it should be a lot of fun to talk about. But I think what we will do is we'll begin with the remastered version versus the old version here, because. Although a lot of this episode takes place planet side and the emphasis is on Spock and his relationship with his crew or lack thereof, there's quite significant changes to the effects as a consequence of the remastered.
Yeah, well, as we all of us here, we saw the original versions, not at the original time, of course, but during the sort of 70s and 80s.
Well, you might have.
I did see the original version of this.
Yeah, at the time,
but
yeah.
It was no, not at the time. I'm not that old, you know.
December 1969 was when it was first shown in the UK. Yeah. Okay.
Oh well, you know.
So I doubt you would have seen it then.
I was still a bit small then. But I probably this episode I've seen probably more times than the average episode of the Star Trek original series. Than any other episode, and I do find it as one of my favourites. And we come back to our Star Trek photo novels.
He's brandishing the photo novel as we speak.
At the moment,
this is your one, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And it's a lovely example of a photo novel. It's actually the first photo novel I got. I'm sorry, I'm deviating from the special effects, but the thing is that the photo novel is actually really cool because it does show you frame by frame the original effects.
Yes, it does.
You know, with lovely glossy colour photographs. But recently in our journey watching all of these Star Trek episodes and reintroducing myself to Star Trek, I've been watching all the remastered episodes. So, I don't have access to the old versions. But thankfully, with the photo novels and some of the YouTube it's people out there who have actually done some comparisons, you can actually see how different the special effects are with the new remaster stuff. Also, some of the stuff that you don't really notice that's there. So, for instance, even the opening title sequences, they remastered all of that as well, which I thought it was was remastered.
So what about Galileo 7 strikes you as being different from?
Well,
from
the main original thing obviously is the shuttlecraft. The actual effects of its time. You can see that everything's they actually built models and they actually had them on wires and stuff like this, the traditional way. And I actually do like the old effects because obviously they filmed them in real time.
Yeah.
And you can notice that sort of compared to the computer animated versions, there is a softness and a warmth to the old special effects because they actually filmed them. And it does look more organic than the really cleaned up, lovely sort of special effects that we have now in
there is a problem with that, isn't there? Because if you get effect, because it's easy to do to like just drop in cutscenes from exterior shots of the Enterprise or the shuttle or whatever, and add new planets and new star systems or new quasars, and make them look glorious and really jump out of the screen. But like when you say it, like you can't just change the shuttle. You can't make a new shuttle because obviously there's planet side stuff when it's landed there, and so the external shots have to look exactly the same.
Yeah.
You can't play around with that. You can't suddenly add new shapes to it because it's gonna look completely different to the one that is there on the planet side, unless you really go deep into it and start doing a hell of a lot of changes on there, completely Lucasize it.
The transition between the CGI bits and the non-CGI bits, I think, are a little bit harsher, harder, I should say, than in Galileo 7 because there's quite a lot of it.
Yeah,
I think the shuttlecraft scenes and the Murasaki quasar scenes are very clean, whereas this is a very old TV show, and the non-CGI scenes are softer.
Yeah.
In appearance, just the edges are just a little bit softer, and I guess if you watch it enough times, you probably just come to notice that. So I found them ever so slightly jarring.
Yeah,
very very enjoyable. The original Murasaki quasar effect was just smoke; it was a cloud of smoke through a filter.
Excellent.
And that's all that they use. It's lovely. I think it's really nice.
Yeah, it does look really nice. I mean,
the new one is lovely as well. But it
looks like an actual quasar.
Looks like a quasar. It's impressive.
And also now it actually defines it in a period of time when it was remastered, because that was the time when we got all of those lovely photographs back from the Hubble.
Yes.
And you noticed them in a lot of TV series. Well, one, for instance, a love of ours is Babylon 5.
Yeah.
They use them all the bloody time. Those lovely sort of, beautiful coloured... sort of quasars and whatever sort of things that they actually got from the Hubble. And you can see that's one of those as well.
Yeah.
They've nicked it from there and then just added a bit of CGI to it. You know,
the shuttlecraft itself, which we presume is another Matt Jeffries creation. There's two versions of it that were created for the show. There's the model for special effects, which is, I think it was about 3 foot long, and then there is a full size one, which took 3 months to make. And we were speculating before we pressed the record button that that we wondered there's probably not much left of it, if anything, at all, because I think after the 3 month build time, and on the Star Trek budget, I don't imagine it was in very good shape by the time they'd finished with it. That being said, that thing got used all the way through the series, because it would have presumably have been reused for subsequent episodes featuring sub shuttlecrafts like Way to Eden and Metamorphosis. And
I mean, the full size shuttle is a wonderful piece of piece of set, especially the way the doors open. I just love it. It's got the four bits of doors. So it opens one side, and then you've got the horizontal bits open.
Well.
It really does look really good.
It also gives some very interesting camera angles in there, mm-hmm. Because of the way they've got the seats planned out,
yeah.
and the direction of this. I'm sorry, I don't know who directed it, but the angles which he uses to build up the tension, because it's a very plain interior.
Yeah,
it's an extremely plain interior. There's a few panels with a few lights on, but other than that, some lovely little bucket seats that they all sit in.
I was going to say, I'm glad you mentioned the seats.
Sure someone somewhere produces versions of those bucket seats. Yeah. I bet you could probably knock those out about 500 quid a time and people would buy those.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Robert Gist, or Gist, G-I-S-T, is the director. I don't recall him directing too many others, but he's a director of...
But you bring up a really valid point about the sort of the angles. In there.
Yeah.
Because it's such a small space.
Yes.
They really have to use the angles of the scene.
Yeah.
You know, they're photographing a slightly different angle numerous times.
Mm.
And so you get quite a lot of different effects, especially there's quite a lot of... points where the camera is actually on the floor,
yes.
pointing upwards.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, there is a bit of a dodgy bit with the
with the Omen,
which is nearly up her skirt.
Yeah, but, I'm sorry to say that I noticed that, which doesn't reflect very well on any of us that we saw that, but we did.
But we did, yes, yeah. But it is great, the use of the camera angles in there, and it does become very claustrophobic, especially when. You feel they could have actually worked on a bit more when they were sort of being, because it turns into a bit of a siege as well.
Yeah.
You know, as well as being the sort of having to sort of be in there, going against time with trying to get, with Scotty trying to get the engines back online and so on, and using sort of another source of fuel. Which is again the another phases, which is a great way of
very clever
of basically put them even into more jeopardy.
Yeah,
as we're going along.
Yes, it's absolutely.
Take away the weapons.
Yeah,
I mean, it is one of those things that there's a lot of different things, a lot of different layers, different themes in there. But it doesn't feel like they're just trying to fill up with a load of tropes and have like a bargain bucket of ideas here. It's actually, although it's not a very complicated story, it's actually. Builds up with the quality of the actors and the acting in there, that it actually they build up the tension.
It's a fine piece of work.
Yeah, and it's another example of using the stage.
Yeah,
and because it is done on a stage set, and it
could be a play.
Set.
Yeah, yeah. It could easily have been a play. You could have removed the
it's like a David Mamet episode. Yeah.
If David Mamet had made Star Trek, who knows? Maybe one day he will. And just having it as a bottle episode, on that one as almost as a stage play, and you could have removed the scenes with on the Enterprise. And still, I sort of think, got away with it.
You could have, but the thing is, you wouldn't want to.
I'm not saying
because
that
you
want
to. It's actually great with the Enterprise scenes are pretty good, especially with the Badmiral in there.
Ferris.
Who, the camera focuses, there's numerous times right at the beginning, it looks like he's smirking.
Yeah, he seems to be genuinely happy that these people... in a kind of, I told you this was a bad idea. I'm so glad I'm right. Never mind that seven people may well be dead.
I think, though, that in those early scenes, though, as well, though, is that it's almost... it's. I think this is one of the recurring themes of the episode is that with along with the relationship of Spock and McCoy in this, there is Ferris is actually Kirk's subconscious, or is his basically the voice in the back of his head. And yeah. that's, he's nearly always standing behind Kirk,
yes.
talking to the back of his head. And Kirk knows what he's got to that's do, and knows what he's got to think of. And you get that, you literally get that in the shuttle with McCoy with talking Coy. To the back.
Well, you said this, you pointed this out, which the front cover of the photo novel has that sequence with McCoy right at the end, where Spock confesses that he may have been mistaken, and McCoy says, well, at least I've lived long enough to hear that. It's a nice picture when he's just over his shoulder. And you pointed out he could almost be an angel on the shoulder of Spock, internally saying to him, you know, pointing out to him the conflict that exists within Spock that is examined often enough with him. I've just had a thought. I wonder if Ferris actually ever existed. he was actually an imagining of Kirk. Just because right from the off.
Yeah.
Because this mission goes wrong almost immediately, doesn't it? I'm sure they probably shaved time, you know, but it seems as though it happens within, you know, in terms of screen time, it happens within seconds. But it seems as though it's not long before it goes wrong. And you could almost say that Ferris didn't exist, but that this was actually an internal discussion going on in Kirk's head that this is probably not a good idea.
Yeah.
He's got business elsewhere. It's a very important business.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't really be stopping to do this.
And it's all that you know, Kirk's internal dick is now given life and given form in the shape of Ferris. Because he's different to Fox, because Fox interacts with other people in there.
Yes.
And I don't think Ferris actually interacts with anyone other than Kirk.
Because there's that one moment when he's leaning up against Uhura's desk. Isn't it? And it's almost like Uhura is blanking him.
Yeah.
And he could easily be a ghost, a figment of the imagination.
He's stranger than Hopkirk, is
he? He doesn't turn up in the epilogue, for example.
Yeah.
So when everyone's back together again.
Yeah. We are going to talk about the epilogue.
Yes, we do have to talk about the epilogue.
But that will be later.
At the end. Yeah.
And also, maybe that's one of the reasons why he's that sort of ominous sort of smirking. He does fit that profile of the devil, sort of.
Yeah. You
know, sort of like those.
He's got a lot of Q about him, actually, hasn't he?
Know.
I was about to say Q. Okay. Yeah. Yep.
You know. But, you know,
and
like.
And he does have that, as you mentioned. We mentioned before we actually went on air. Actually, that sort of his fashion sense is quite interesting, especially with his cape, that little sort of cape.
The more and more we talk about it, the more he's like Q, isn't he? Basically,
I think that it's a distinct possibility that he could actually be a proto Q, or just a figment of. Wouldn't it be funny? Well, I'm glad we got rid of that guy Ferris. You know, he was an absolute nuisance.
Gonna go who?
Ferris? Who? Sorry, who?
Boom,
Ferris?
Boom.
That would have been... Yes. Okay, well, let's get into the scenes on the planet then. Because this is what the episode really is all about, I suppose, isn't it? And it's about Spock and his interacting... The fact that this appears to be his first command. And it's certainly strongly implied by McCoy that this is his first command, which I'm not sure about.
No.
Because he goes back a long way. I mean, he was an officer for a long time. It's likely that he's commanded landing parties or away missions, as they went on to become known as. So anyway, but the point is this is a guy unfamiliar with making big decisions, deferring them to the captain, and it's an examination of his nature as a half human and a half Vulcan, and how he manages that. And at the beginning, it doesn't do very well, does it?
Well, I suppose technically, if you're looking the sort of like the canon and lore of Star Trek, then I suppose he is very new to the role of first officer, having taken it over.
Yeah.
After
Mitchell, yeah.
So I mean, I suppose there is that way that this could be his first foray into there.
Yes, it's conceivable. Being allowed
to go, and perhaps not his first command, but the first commanding the first situation that's gone horribly wrong.
Mm. Yeah, so no, maybe definitely there. Yeah, so yeah, no, never managed to cross the situation like this.
As they called him, sort of, they sort of insinuate him as being a captain on this command. You know, yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because he has a ship.
Yes, yes, and a crew.
Yeah,
yeah, that's probably it. More likely, isn't it? Really?
Peculiar mix-up of the crew.
Yeah,
having Scotty, the chief engineer, and McCoy, the chief medical officer,
both
on board.
Them, yeah,
that seems like an. I mean, I'm wondering why
for an observation. Guys are there. Yeah. But the only reason they're there is because they're regular characters, and yes. So add more jeopardy.
Yes, obviously that's why they're there. But it's an odd choice. But yes, I mean, we've got. This is an episode that's being led by Nimoy,
yeah.
And not by Shatner, and maybe they felt that he needed some main characters to, you know, keep the audience engaged.
Yeah. And it's, well, it's McCoy's obviously there to be the polar opposite, as he always is,
yeah.
of Spock.
Mm.
It's the one who's meant to be all about.
But he's actually quite sympathetic.
I was going to say, is he antagonistic towards?
No, because they leave that to Bomer, don't they? Yeah. Really, and they've got Bomer and they've got Gaetano.
And then Latimer. But yeah. He doesn't last very long.
He doesn't last very long.
But it's mostly Bomer and Gaetano until Gaetano meets his sad end.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I think you have to have that because you have to have people who aren't going to be in every episode coming up. So you don't have to have that sort of antagonism bubbling under.
Mm.
You've obviously got the antagonism between Spock and McCoy.
Mm.
That's a given. But Scotty's very interesting in this episode because he doesn't waver at all.
No.
And when they're burying Latimer, or when they're having the discussion about Latimer's burial, Scotty is just getting on with his job.
Yeah.
And no one's getting on his back for just doing what he's doing.
No, only that one time in which, you know, Scotty makes it clear that, you know, a phaser can only drain so fast.
Yeah.
Which, of course, you know,
of course.
Everybody should know this. And McCoy really ought to know this, you know. But he definitely mansplains it to McCoy, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He definitely... He's sort of like, you really ought to know this.
Yeah.
You know, you really ought to know this about this phaser. They only drain so fast.
This is phaser two, after all.
Yeah, it's we want to know better phaser threes, you know, then, you know, I'll get the drain quicker.
Mm.
Scotty, I think, allows himself to put himself above all those arguments and the tension that's there. I think he also it works quite nicely because Scotty has actually commanded the starship before. And we've discussed how he's done, and we'll go on to do that when Kirk and Spock are down planetside. Scotty's usually the guy in charge. On this occasion, I think Scotty perhaps. I'm sure this isn't implied in the script, but it so happens he probably knows what Spock is going through and knows that it's best to just defer to his authority, even if you're sitting there thinking this is not a good idea. He only rushes to his defence when Bomer crosses the line.
Mr. Gaetano's body is back there.
It will, of course, have to be left behind.
Not without a burial.
I wouldn't recommend it. The creatures won't be far away.
Not without a burial, Mr. Spock.
It would expose members of this crew to unnecessary peril.
I'll take that chance. You see, Mr. Spock, I would insist upon a decent burial, even if your body was back there.
Mr. Bomer.
But I'm sick and tired of this machine.
That's enough.
Gentlemen. All right, Mr. Bomer, you'll have your burial. Provided the creatures will permit it.
A few words about Bomer, the character.
Yeah.
Well, the actor Don Marshall went on to Land of the Giants, an interesting character, really very, very full, given that actually didn't have that much to do, but really good as the antagonist to Spock, as the principal antagonist to Spock.
And
brilliant acting by Don Marshall, you've got to say.
He really
owned that character in a very short space of time. I remember at the time being surprised to never see him again.
Yeah,
the way that he was, you would have thought he was the way he carried out with script, he struck me as being a series regular.
Yeah, well, I mean, he gets a lot more screen time, obviously, than Gaetano and Latimer, but the whole way that he goes in there, he's obviously stand out. He's not just a standing actor like the other three.
Yeah.
Mears, isn't it? The young man in there.
Yes.
Who was meant to be Rand.
Yes, she was meant to be Rand, but Rand had been written out already. Yeah.
So you've got ones there that have got just they're just basically filling seats, and he's not. He's actually a really pivotal.
Yeah.
Well, he develops as he goes through.
Yes.
I mean, the thing is, that's really interesting when it starts off. You know, it's all matter of fact, and then his character does change as the situation changes.
Mm. Spock changes as well. because at the end there, where Boimler, you know, says something too harsh to Spock, and Spock doesn't react coldly. In fact, if anything, he seems to be reacting with more sympathy for the. I think he understands that he's probably handled this situation badly, and now that's why Boimler is acting the way that he is, and Spock has to acknowledge that he has to share a degree of responsibility for this unpleasant situation with the crew. And so when he's calmly explaining to Boimler that this was not a good idea, there's big furry creatures outside looking to kill us. If we go out there, we'll be in jeopardy. But since you're upset about it, and since I've upset about you about it, let's do it then. We'll give it a go. We'll give it a shot. And that kind of completes the arc that Spock embarks upon. He begins it by suggesting that it would be a good idea to leave three people behind on the planet in order for them to escape. So it's quite a journey, isn't it?
Yes.
And his initial reluctance to give the inhabitants a bloody nose by, you know, killing them or fighting back by firing warning shots. All of these things backfire, and he doesn't handle the whole thing well at all, does he?
No, he doesn't.
He gets very tetchy in this.
Yeah.
But I suppose there is, because there aren't any security men on board there.
No.
There's no red shirts.
To say, look, we should do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to say, look, actually the right, because you would think that when they're not being killed,
yeah,
security people would know what would have trained into different environments,
yeah,
and what to do when you're dealing with.
And it's also, of course, is the sort of thing that that Kirk does all the time.
Yeah,
he goes into combat situations.
And throws a red shirt in front of him.
Yeah, throws a red shirt in front of him.
Over there, yeah. Go over there and see if they're shooting it.
And then you know, mourns over his bloody corpse, and then goes on and fights again.
Goes again. He learns nothing.
Yes, yeah. That's it. The score in this one actually was red shirts 2, gold shirts 0.
You mentioned that
the two red shirts do survive, don't
they? They do. You mentioned that Spock got tetchy, and he did. He gets tetchy when he's confronted with the prospect of having to kill the natives, one of the natives. He gets quite angry with them, doesn't he? And when he's trying to explain, weighing up, there's a responsibility to these people that, you know, they didn't ask for this ship to arrive. They're reacting in a way that is completely unnatural for them, because spaceships don't usually land on their planet. And they're messing up the whole thing. So he's aware of those broader implications, and that actually their lives are not worth saving necessarily if it means messing up the lives of essentially innocents, even though they're trying to kill them. And it's very enlightened. It's very Star Trek. It's very Spock.
Yeah.
But he delivers it in a very angry, his tone is angry.
Very angry.
But to take life indiscriminately.
The majority.
I'm not interested in the opinion of the majority, Mr. Gaetano. The components must be weighed. Our dangers to ourselves as well as our duties to other life forms, friendly or not.
And that's very emotional, rather than sort of like, this is an episode where actually they put to bed the emotion is logic. It's actually logic is a thing that sort of like controls Spock, but he can be emotional as well.
Mm.
You know, it's not a case of him being just an unemotional machine. Because he does get angry quite early on, I think, in this episode. You know, and I expect him to turn around and slap one of them in the face.
Just returning to the character of Boimler, I mean, he's a black man.
Yeah.
And you don't see many black men in leading roles. Do you think that his... it's not an easy question for us to answer. Do you think that his... his role is a positive role, or do you think, or not? I mean, what do you think in that context?
In the context of what it is, and being released in 1967, so right at the height of the civil rights movement as well. There's going to be a lot of people there that are thinking, well, you know, a black voice.
Yeah.
What does that bring across? That comes across with a lot of other baggage, doesn't it?
If you will.
if you're presenting it on a TV show at this time.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult for us to look back on it now, although we can portray other issues on there, the ones that we see every day now, to the issues that were there and prevalent in the late 60s.
Mm.
He has got a positive role, but I think, as I said earlier, it's not he the antagonism that he has there is almost due to the freedom he has of being a guest star.
Right.
So that he's allowed to get away. And that's not anything to do with his colour, but I think it's accentuated maybe at the time, or maybe that was in the thoughts of casting. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just the fact that, like, you know, we want to have a little bit of diversity. We'll have one woman here, we'll have one black guy here. So very much 60s, I don't want to say tokenism, but there, I just said it.
But you just did.
Yeah.
Well, I look at the actual the character itself as being the everyman character. So he's actually the every Joe character, because you've still got in place.
Exactly,
you've
still
got an officer structure.
Yeah.
Because you've got like Spock, Scott, and
yeah, the McCoy. Chain of command is still there.
Still there.
Yeah.
And he is just a grunt. You know, he's
a lieutenant. He's a lieutenant.
Oh, he's a lieutenant. Okay.
I mean, he's an officer.
He does come across as being the everyman character, who's the ordinary character who you don't see all the time.
Yeah.
Who has a voice.
Well, it's very interesting after Gaetano, because Gaetano is almost left to die.
Yeah.
Isn't he really? And it could be that, of course, well, am I the next one to
yeah.
Well, you know, yeah. I know I'm the black guy. I die in the fourth reel. You know, it's
Boma taps him on the shoulder as he's sort of like making his way off there in a kind of, you know, unlucky mate kind of way. And you need to try and sympathise, but also perhaps in a kind of, well, yeah, that'll be me next.
Yeah.
McCoy's got a great line there, hasn't he? When Spock goes off to look for Gaetano's, what we assume is his body, to try and has a scientific curiosity for what's happened to him. And McCoy says, he risks his life to go looking for him, and he's just as likely to order him to stay when he finds him. You know, yet Spock is being very cold and very difficult about this. And the reaction of Boma and Gaetano and McCoy to and even to a smaller extent Mears, who, as we can probably, as we know, as usual, being the only female there, doesn't get much to do, sadly. Yeah. I'll talk about that. I'll ask you something about that in a second. They are, through their antagonism towards him, they are forcing Spock down a path which is a little bit more of a compromise to his sort of logical values and more tapping into, you know, the human side and to who he really is, and realizing that he's dealing with human beings, he's dealing with people and not just numbers on a board, so to speak. Very quickly, do you think that, I think personally it's a tragedy that Yeoman Rand never developed as a character in Star Trek. Do you think that had she been in this episode that character would have got more lines if it had been Rand instead of Mears?
I don't think so at all. I think if you look at the length of time it gave them to develop Uhura, really. Mm. I mean, she's not really developed at all in the series. And it's only in the subsequent films that you see that her character is slightly more developed. But I just don't think there is... It's a lot like with a lot of the other characters in there. You'll get an occasional tidbit of backstory there or fleshing out the characters, but you really don't see a lot of it, do you, really?
No.
And I don't think you would have got any more had it been a regular female cast character there.
In the early episodes, Rand is given quite a bit to do. I mean, particularly Miri, which I think is a kind of her last one, although that's a problematic episode. She's got quite a lot. I do wonder whether or not if that character had developed, then when it came to writing it, then they might have shifted the dynamic within the group. It would have been a different episode, but you're quite possibly right about that, sadly. So Hua Chung, the designer, designed the aliens for this episode. He also designed a number of the small gadgets for Star Trek, a noted well-known designer of his age.
If he designed the ones Scotty's gadgets, they were beautiful.
Yeah,
I'm not the toy box.
I can't remember which ones that they are, but I think that I get the impression that they were all very pleased to have got his services for this very very talented noted designer. Those aliens then.
Yeah.
Well, they're not aliens, they're really native.
No, of course they're not aliens. Yeah, yes.
Yes.
Right. Thank you, Derek, for pointing that out. So the natives then, if we can call them that. What do we make of those? Big spears.
Huge spears.
You know what they say about big spears.
Well, they weren't big spears when they threw them, were they? They were tiny spears.
They were. Yeah, to make them look. Yeah.
may I say that the best thing about the natives was the huge footprints they leave, which are hilarious, and I hope they remain the same in the remastered version.
Oh yeah, no, I think they ever so slightly enhanced. If
are
anything,
they really?
yeah, I noticed them, but I think they clean up the film, don't they? So you just see them there. The networks were not entirely happy with some of the scenes proposed in this episode in relation to the. Natives. When Latimer was impaled, they had to reshoot, I think, because initially it was pretty graphic.
Yeah.
But they had to add a little bit of extra smoke and a bit more mist to cover that up. Interesting, sort of like good aliens, bad aliens. What would you say?
I think that they are pretty good aliens. You don't see them.
Yeah.
I mean, you only
they're basically superior. Monsters, aren't they? That's what they've monsters, got to be. They've just got monsters. To be. Yeah,
but the rubbing of wood on leather to wind up to scare the aliens is pretty cool, isn't it?
I mean, it starts off really good. That sort of it was one of those sort of sieges. It could have turned into a different sort of feel if they were if they built more on that when they were sort of like surrounding them or making the sounds, they could have actually really turned it into a Western again. I mean, Westerns always pop up in Star Trek anyway.
We only ever see one, don't we?
No, we only see the back of it, don't we?
So, yeah. And then
you've only got one wagon though, so you can't really form a circle, can you?
Yeah. And when the one alien is smashing that comedy rock on the shuttle. What's our impression of Spock's solution? I mean, this is Spock's turning point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because he has that massive meltdown when he says, when he's basically saying, I've messed this up completely.
Yeah.
I've alienated you. Two people are dead. And there's this huge alien who I thought by shooting at would go away.
Yeah.
And he's now trying to kill us.
I've got an idea.
And I'm completely spinning out.
Why don't you take a spanner, put it over the terminals of the battery, and then...
But that's his
turn. And electrocute us all.
Yeah.
But that's
everybody, stand away from the walls, that'll do.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there really should have been a warning. Hopefully there was a warning. Do not try this at
home. Do not rattle a spanner over your car battery.
And anyone around you, yeah.
Make sure you have some really fabulous black sort of shimmery gloves.
Those gloves were awesome. And Scotty's pose when he's standing back there in a kind of...
It's one of his most famous poses, though, that one.
It is, I think, in
the whole series.
I will say this. This is not the first time I've said this. But Jimmy Doohan is a superb actor.
Yeah.
And I know he's typecast as Scotty. But he completely... But given that he has to convince audiences... that something amazing is happening using the tiniest of budgets.
Yeah.
So he goes running up Jeffrey's tube, sort of like plugging stuff in and out and making it look convincing. And, you know, he uses a spanner to try and get this, do this really cool and amazing things. When, I've said it in previous episodes, in Star Trek 2, we know Spock is dying because Jimmy Doohan is telling us, all Spock is doing is standing in an empty room. But Jimmy Doohan is telling us that he's in colossal peril because of Jimmy Doohan's reaction.
Mm-hmm.
He is a brilliant actor, was a brilliant actor. Shouldn't be underestimated at all. And he does well in this one as well. But that's Spock's turning point, isn't it? Mm. That's where Spock goes, right, I've got an idea, let's do this. And then things start to, you know, get better for him ever so much. We're coming close to the end of our discussion about this, but I think we should end this discussion. At the ending. There is the act of desperation, isn't there? Did you want to talk about that, or are we're pretty?
I think we're pretty happy with that.
Yeah.
I would like to know how they ended up in the transporter room though, because they're all sat down, and I wonder if they all fell on their asses.
I've always wondered that. Does the transporter just correct you and reassembles you in a standing position? Which I would find bizarre. Teleportation is really creepy.
I do like that idea of them just like going, whoa, taking the things away from
them. Any injuries? Well, not before they've been aboard. Afterwards, yes, massive concussion.
Yeah. They all fell over. It was like great. Oh, maybe what they do is they actually transport them all in a circle, so they're all sat on each other's laps.
That would be lovely.
Like little sort of
yeah.
That's why Boma doesn't appear in the epilogue as well, is it? Because he's actually downstairs being treated because they all landed on him. The epilogue then, where Kirk quizzes Spock. Where do you want to begin with the epilogue?
This could
be a podcast of itself.
Yeah. It's entirely separate from the episode itself, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone's back together again. They're all, and that's a bit bizarre. And then there's the not unfamiliar epilogue trope of goading Spock either into an emotional reaction or into
telling you how stubborn he is.
Yes, telling you how stubborn he is. Yes.
There's hope for you yet.
And, it's quite a long epilogue anyway, at the best of times. It's
drawn out, I think.
And it finishes with the longest laugh I think you've ever seen. And there's me praising Jimmy Doohan as an actor. And then I've completely forgotten, of course, that he is possibly the biggest perpetrator of this atrocious ending scene. He's leaning up against the wall.
Yeah.
Just like that.
Yeah. Laughing away. having to put his arm out because he's laughing so hard.
The photo novel is amazing because it's got the... Because almost everyone is there and it's got them all laughing. So it's got Spock saying, "Yes, sir." And then McCoy goes, "Ha, ha, ha." Then supernumerative goes, "Ha, ha." Kirk goes, "Ho, ho, ho."
Yeah, because he's captain.
Navigator guy, not Chekhov, goes, "He, he, he." Scotty goes, "Ho, ho," in bold. And Sulu is finishing up with, "Ha, ha, ha." And that pretty much sums up that epilogue. And it just goes on for so long. I watched this with my friend Martin once. And we just watched it. And we just went, it's never going to end. They're never going to stop. That's how funny it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. After all the death and destruction.
Yeah. And then the fact that two people had been killed.
Yeah.
And the fact that another one had been killed on the landing party as well.
Yeah.
Killed by one of the natives. So, you know, amidst all this tragedy, they found some light.
And of course, they laugh so hard that Kirk completely forgets his imaginary friend.
Indeed. His imaginary friend probably just disappears. Okay, my work is done. No doubt to be replaced by another imaginary friend next week.
Drop dead Ferris.
It's interesting because the actor who played Ferris, I'm afraid his name escapes me, I'm sorry to say.
Crawford, is it?
No, Oliver Crawford is the writer.
Oh.
He said that he had a really bad time, apparently, on that set with Shatner.
Oh.
They did not get on. So that's interesting. I wonder whether or not they got that. Oh, thanks for the Mr. Ferris. Oh, yeah, of course, because they do the cast list, don't they? Isn't that lovely? John Crawford. Yes, you're quite right. Okay. I apologise. Who wrote it then? Was it Oliver Crawford? Yeah. Oliver Crawford was the writer.
I wonder if they were related.
I wonder whether they were related. Oliver Crawford, a veteran screenwriter, not much science fiction. Anyway, I think we should finish. Thank you very much for participating, guys.
Great discussion.
Great chat. And thank you, listeners, for doing the listening part. HomePods Destroy is our website. HomePodsDestroy.com is the website. There you can find links to Twitter, to our iTunes, to our podcatcher. There's even an Og Vorbis file of this podcast available if you're an Og Vorbis kind of person. And, you know, they do exist. And we're all about the VHS v beta dynamic here. And so I'm always happy to promote the Og Vorbis thing.
Yeah.
So
there's not an analog version available though.
There isn't an analog version.
Cassette tape very shortly.
Yeah. Yes, that could definitely happen. You're laughing.
But audio cassette by mail.
Yes. If you want it, listeners, and you're happy to pay for it, then we'll make that happen.
Yeah.
We'll totally make that happen. There's nothing too hipsterish for Whom Pods Destroy, as you can tell by the name of the title of the podcast. I forgot to mention that just for a second in the remastered version, they replaced the chronometers with digital chronometers.
Oh, I noticed that, yeah.
Which is bullshit.
Yes. Yeah,
they replaced the analog.
Utter
that
bullshit.
Was completely unnecessary.
Yeah, that's one of the best things about the bridge in the Enterprise is it's analog.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
Nice, you know, gears and, you know, the actual numbers turning
round. Yeah, there's no reason why in the 23rd century you can't have analog.
No.
I think there's a whole argument to be made. It's always the Battlestar Galactica argument, isn't it? The reason why Battlestar Galactica didn't get done in when the silent is because it was analog. It wasn't connected to the network.
Nah.
There you go, you see. Anyway, we should definitely end now. So what I'll do is I'll thank you very much for listening. Thank you for contributing. And I'll ask you, all of you, to end this episode as they end the Galileo 7 with a big laugh. Come on, listeners.
Cut.
That sounded a bit too much.
Too much laughter, love. No, that's fine. Not enough laughter. No, maybe not enough. Okay, second take. Should more laughter. Yeah. Lovely. Okay, press that button. Don't worry.